please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration has imposed sweeping technology restrictions on China. New rules include measures to exclude China from using semiconductor chips made anywhere in the world with U.S. tools. We look at the world media's coverage of this story. Reuters news agency has more on the story. The Biden administration on Friday, 7th of October, published a sweeping set of export controls, including a measure to cut China off from certain semiconductor chips made anywhere in the world with U.S. tools, vastly expanding its reach in its attempt to slow Beijing's technological and military advancement. The rules, some of which go into effect immediately, build on restrictions sent in letters earlier this year to top toolmakers, KLA Core, Lam Research Core, and Applied Materials Inc., in effect requiring them to halt shipments of equipment to wholly Chinese-owned factories producing advanced logic chips. The raft of measures could amount to the biggest shift in U.S. policy towards shipping technology to China since the 1990s. If effective, they could set China's chip manufacturing industry back years by forcing American and foreign companies that use U.S. technology to cut off support for some of China's leading factories and chip designers. In a briefing with reporters on Thursday, 6th of October, previewing the rules, senior U.S. government officials said many of the rules sought to prevent foreign firms from selling advanced chips to China or supplying Chinese firms with tools to make their own advanced chips. They conceded, however, that they had not yet secured any promises that allied nations will implement similar measures and that discussions with those nations were ongoing. "We recognize that the unilateral controls we're putting into place will lose effectiveness over time if other countries don't join us," one U.S. official said. "And we risk harming U.S. technology leadership if foreign competitors are not subject to similar controls." The expansion of U.S. powers to control exports to China of electronic chips made with U.S. tools is based on a broadening of the so-called Foreign Direct Product Rule. It was previously expanded to give the U.S. government authority to control exports of chips made overseas to Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei Technologies, and later to stop the flow of semiconductors to Russia. Early on Friday, the United States added China's top memory chip maker, YMTC, and 30 other Chinese firms to a list of companies that U.S. officials cannot inspect, ratcheting up tensions with Beijing and taking aim at a firm that has long troubled the Biden administration. The Washington Post has more on the same story. The Biden administration on Friday, 7th of October, announced its most aggressive measures to date aimed at limiting China's access to advanced computer chips and chip-making equipment, saying that the technology is supporting China's military modernization and even its development of weapons of mass destruction. The Biden administration said it was focusing solely on the semiconductor chips, activities and entities of greatest national security concern in China to minimize harm to the American chip industry, foundational to the U.S. economy, and disruptions to the global supply chain. The move represents a clear flexing of U.S. muscle in its competition with China, with analysts saying it amounts to a new strategy of high-tech containment of China. But officials also acknowledged the effort could backfire on the United States without buy-in from foreign partners and allies. "We recognize that the unilateral controls we're putting into place tomorrow will lose effectiveness over time if other countries don't join us, and we risk harming U.S. technology leadership if foreign competitors are not subject to similar controls," said a senior Biden administration official who spoke on condition of anonymity. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan last month said the administration was seeking to shed the old approach of maintaining a relative advantage in key technologies to blowing open as large a lead as possible. The export controls imposed on Russia by the United States and 37 other countries earlier this year showed that such tools can do more than just prevent gains, Jake Sullivan said. Sullivan added, "They can be a new strategic asset in the United States and allied toolkit to impose costs on adversaries and even over time degrade their battlefield capabilities." But that collective effort success only underscores the need for similar support from allies with this action, said William Reinsch, a senior U.S. Commerce Department official in the Clinton administration, but now at the Center for Strategic and International Security. William Reinsch added, "This won't work unless the affected governments and companies are willing to cooperate. You're always walking a fine line between controlling too much and too little. If you control too much, then you're kneecapping your own guys, their ability to invest in new technologies." The new rules were released by the U.S. Commerce Department on Friday, 7th of October. The Semiconductor Industry Association, which represents nearly all of the U.S. semiconductor industry by revenue and almost two-thirds of non-U.S. chip firms, said in a statement it was assessing the new rules' impact and would work with members to ensure compliance. The British newspaper, the Financial Times, has also covered the same story. The United States has introduced sweeping export controls that will severely complicate efforts by Chinese companies to develop cutting-edge technologies with military applications in one of the toughest actions President Joe Biden has taken against China. The U.S. Commerce Department on Friday, 7th of October, announced restrictions that will make it extremely hard for Chinese companies to obtain or manufacture advanced computer chips and will slow their progress in artificial intelligence. The measures are also designed to make it much tougher for China to develop supercomputers with military applications. The controls mark a new attempt to decouple China from the United States in the cutting-edge technologies. They come days before Chinese President Xi Jinping is expected to seal a third term as leader of China at the 20th National Congress of China. Paul Triolo, a China and technology expert at Albright Stonebridge, a consultancy firm, said the action was a major watershed in U.S.-China relations and in the increasingly intense technology competition between Washington and Beijing. The U.S. has essentially declared war on China's ability to advance the country's use of high-performance computing for economic and security gains, said Paul Triolo. The controls will hit Chinese companies in multiple ways. They will bar U.S. companies from exporting critical chip manufacturing tools to China, which will affect groups such as Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corp., Yangtze Memory Technologies Corp., and Changxin Memory.
Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
A song that has the fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Thank you. some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises. May they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 November 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
उन्होंने इस घर की इब्तिदा की 6 फरवरी 1861
The house here was built by his grandfather Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February, 1861, he bought three small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and four sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hisamuddin Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and compose his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world, a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through two periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I made much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, Mac Nicrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions, He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests,
and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
After the attacks by the extremist and far-right supporters of the former U.S. President Donald Trump on Capitol Hill on 6th of January 2021 and their attempt to change election results in favor of their party and to prevent the approval of current President Joe Biden, what was perceived to be democracy in America is now seriously being questioned and criticized. Recently, American politicians are trying to portray each other as a threat to democracy. For example, President Joe Biden recently, in a speech in Philadelphia, said, "Democracy and equality in America are facing threats, and we must protect our values. The threats to democracy in America are real." We have prepared for you a selection of press and media articles on this issue. Please stay with us. NBC News website writes, President Joe Biden accused former U.S. President Donald Trump and his supporters of promoting an extreme ideology that threatens democracy in a rare primetime remarks on Thursday, 1st of September, as he stepped up attacks on conservatives ahead of next November's midterm elections. President Biden said in a speech from the Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia, he said, "Too much of what's happening in our country today is not normal. Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic." He accused so-called MAGA Republicans, a reference to Donald Trump's Make America Great Again slogan, of refusing to recognize free and fair elections, increasingly talking about violence in response to actions they don't like, and of being determined to thwart the will of the American people. President Biden said, "MAGA Republicans have made their choice. They embrace anger. They thrive on chaos. They live not in the light of truth, but in the shadow of lies." Biden claimed, "Not every Republican embraces their extreme ideology. I know because I've been able to work with these mainstream Republicans. But there's no question that the Republican Party today is dominated, driven, and intimidated by Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans, and that is a real threat to this country." President Biden laid into those who have embraced Trump's false claim that the 2020 presidential election was rigged and sought to disrupt the coming 2022 midterm elections, calling the belief a threat to the fundamentals of American democracy. Thank you. Explaining more about this issue, VanityFair.com website reported, in his first rally in the wake of the 8th of August Mar-a-Lago search, former U.S. President Donald Trump lambasted current President Joe Biden, the Justice Department, and Lieutenant Governor of Pennsylvania, John Fetterman. On Saturday night, 3rd of September, in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump called the President of the United States an enemy of the state. This fiery accusation was likely fueled by comments Biden made in a speech on Thursday, 1st of September. Biden said, Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic and democracy. Trump further described Biden's speech on Thursday at Independence Hall as the most vicious, hateful, and divisive speech ever delivered by an American president. Addressing the FBI search of his Florida home at Mar-a-Lago, Trump called the Justice Department vicious monsters who executed a shameful raid and break-in of my home in Mar-a-Lago. He also called the search one of the most shocking abuses of power by any administration in American history. Saturday night's incendiary rally echoed Trump's presence on his social media platform, Truth Social, recently. According to the New York Times, he posted 88 times in a 24-hour period, including calling Biden's health into question after the president gave his speech on Thursday. If you look at the words and meaning of the awkward and angry Biden speech tonight, he threatened American democracy, including with the possible use of military force. He must be insane or suffering from late-stage dementia. His comments come as speculation intensifies about Trump announcing his intentions to run for president in 2024, ahead of the 2022 midterm elections. But Donald Trump's political ambitions could be derailed by a series of criminal and civil litigations against him, including the legal jeopardy he faces after being caught in possession of sensitive government documents at his home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. Newsweek also reported on the same issue from a different angle. U.S. Senator Patty Murray has said that democracy is at risk in the United States and defended a controversial speech that President Joe Biden made recently. He said on Sunday, 4th of September, during an interview with CNN, that supporters of former President Donald Trump were willing to use brute force to halt the peaceful transition of power on 6th of January 2021. When thousands of people marched against the certification of the 2020 election, which placed Biden in office as the current president. Patty Murray said, I believe that our democracy is at risk today. I was in the nation's capital on 6th of January 2021. I wasn't able to escape. I was barricaded in an office. And I heard the pounding at the door, and I heard those who were outside of it willing to use brute force incited by President Trump to take over our country, to take over our democracy, to stop the transition to a new presidency in a peaceful way, which is what democracy is all about. She said, we have to get back to a point where we all say that brute force and incitement of that brute force, and the question that the president and his followers continue to put out there about whether or not that election was legitimate, incites that. She added, and we will have people today saying there will be violence on the streets. That is not what democracy is all about, and we all have to point that out and work to make sure we move towards democracy and keep that democracy. On 6th of January 2021, Trump supporters occupied the U.S. Capitol while lawmakers were in the process of reviewing the certification of state electors, which indicated Biden's victory. Some Trump supporters had hoped that this process could have resulted in some of the electors being disqualified, thus overturning the outcome of the presidential election. It is claimed by some that the demonstrators were infiltrated and incited by provocateurs from U.S. intelligence agencies who orchestrated the false flag operation in order to get rid of Donald Trump. Some among the crowd clashed with police officers and some made threats to beat up a number of Democratic lawmakers. Some also inflicted damage on parts of the Capitol building. Joe Biden, in his speech on Thursday, condemned Donald Trump, saying that the former president and his supporters are determined to take this country backward. Biden said, "Backward to an America where there is no right to choose, no right to privacy, no right to contraception, and no right to marry who you love." Trump has claimed that the January 6, 2021 protests represented the greatest movement in the history of our country. He said in June, "January 6 was not simply a protest, it represented the greatest movement in the history of our country to make America great again."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Another example of anfal is mineral wealth, ma'adin, that is extracted from beneath the ground. Yet another example is the forests, the deserts, or the great pastures in valleys or on mountains. In short, anfal denotes any kind of wealth that does not belong to a single person or to a single group of people, but rather is public property, belonging to the nation as a collective. However, one of the aforementioned examples are those spoils won by soldiers in warfare. The first time this question seems to have been raised was after the Battle of Badr, when the Muslims were discussing how they should divide the spoils they had won. They disagreed with one another, so they referred the matter to the Prophet and asked him what they should do. Their answer came in the form of the aforementioned verse of the Quran. Say, the Anfal belong to Allah and the Apostle. What does it mean when the Quran says they belong to Allah? Means that they do not belong to any one particular group of people. Anything that belongs to Allah, anything that is said to be God's property, actually means something that should be used for godly aims.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Clearly, when we say that something belongs to God, we do not mean that it should be spent for God's benefit, because God does not benefit from wealth. God does not have any needs. God does not have any wants. So there is no need to spend His wealth to fulfill these. On the contrary, when we speak of God's property, we mean the property of all of His servants. Therefore, His wealth should be used for those causes alone which God has specified. This is the meaning of saying something belongs to Allah. And the Apostle, what does this mean? That it is the property of the Messenger. Yes, but what does that mean? Is the Prophet the polar opposite of God? Of course not. But when we say something belongs to Allah, someone might come along and give himself the right to do with it as he pleases, because it belongs to no one in particular. He can say, this belongs to Allah and we are all Allah's servants. So using this pleasant-sounding and attractive slogan, the person can use something that belongs to everyone for his own personal benefit. Therefore, while Allah's wealth is supposed to be used for the benefit of all the Muslims and all of God's true servants, using it for the public good does not mean it can be used haphazardly as anyone pleases. On the contrary, there should be some management of this wealth. There should be someone in charge of it as God's representative who will look after people's interests.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The second Caspian Economic Forum has been held in Moscow. During the event, issues including developing trade and economic cooperation, interaction in the field of ecology, energy, transport, and logistics were discussed. Delegations from the Caspian five littoral states, namely Russia, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran, and Azerbaijan, were present at the event.
The countries of the Caspian region will have to work in the current turbulent conditions of the global economy and geostrategic tensions. The West is putting increasing pressure on other countries in an attempt to maintain the existing world order.
The Caspian region possesses a significant part of the world's gas and oil reserves. It is of high significance, especially at a time when the whole world is facing an unprecedented energy crisis. The Iranian authorities came up with a new proposal to address those issues.
In order to unify and harmonize tariffs for rail, road and sea transportation, expanding trade and economic cooperation, we propose to establish a committee for cooperation in the field of transport, transit and customs business.
The Islamic Republic, given its geographical location, has very good opportunities to conduct operations in the oil and gas sector, as well as providing energy supplies to other regions. Iran has stressed the need to accelerate the unification of the country's electric power networks with those of the Caspian states.
The main purpose of this forum is boosting the economy of regional countries and to enable the Caspian states to use their opportunities to develop trade and economic cooperation, culture and tourism. Also, everyone should not only use the opportunities of the Caspian Sea, but also protect it. We are actively working in the development of the North-South Transport Corridor. The shipping lines of the Islamic Republic of Iran have allocated 300 containers for the transportation of goods to Russia.
Apart from what was said and proposed at the event, the forum also had good news for the member states. Cruise shipping on the Caspian Sea is set to begin in 2023 for the first time in history.
More than 1,000 delegates from the five Caspian Sea littoral states, as well as Belarus, Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, have taken part in the forum. In the meeting, the participants agreed to adopt decisions to enhance all-out cooperation among countries in the Caspian region. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The battered village of Golmovsky. The front line is only 100 meters away. There is a deadly tension here, as the streets are almost deserted.
And there are a few people on the streets here picking up humanitarian supplies. I've tried to speak to some of them, but they just shake their head and say, I'd like to speak to you, but we just need to rush home because it's too dangerous here. There's shelling at any moment. They can be hit.
In some relative shelter, this man would speak to me.
Are you concerned about Ukrainian advances to the north of here?
No, I don't think they will come here. Everyone will rise up and won't let them. The people here have nowhere else to go. They couldn't beat us when there were only a few of us, and now Russia supports us.
And what do you think of the Ukrainians and the Ukrainian military?
They are not human. They know perfectly well where they shell. The square here is full of craters. Women were killed just over there while working. They know what they target.
It is mostly the elderly who remain in this town. They have nowhere else to go, and so are stranded in the middle of an artillery duel between the opposing armies. The boom of outgoing fire, a pro-Russian artillery piece, can't be far from the village. This man tells me he's 76 years old. He fears the coming winter, as his windows have been smashed by a blast. He also blames the Ukrainians for the war, and says they were sent here by the Americans and the Europeans. We head to the neighboring village of Zaitsevo. It was fully taken by pro-Russian forces a couple of weeks ago.
The front line's a couple of hundred meters away from here. It's understandably a ghost town at the moment. Very few civilians are here. Now, Barmut, a major settlement, isn't too far to the north of here. The Russians, or the pro-Russians, have been trying to take that settlement for months now. And just further to the north of that is Lyman, where the Ukrainian army has had some major successes in the last few days.
The situation is unstable. As you know, Zaitsevo is finally completely liberated. All its parts are now under our control. I think being here today, you'll hear that it's quite loud at the front lines. Artillery, both ours and the enemy's, are working. It's still early to relax.
Are you concerned about the Ukrainian advances to the north?
The north of our republic is a bit far from us. In our direction, it's only our forces that are moving forward. What's going on there decides nothing for us.
Amongst the deadly tension of this village, the incongruous sight of a rose garden. It houses a monument to civilians killed by Ukrainian shelling. It was built 18 months before the Russians sent their army across the border in February. A reminder that Ukraine has been bombing pro-Russian areas here for 8 years.
I lived and worked here in the village and saw what's going on. I can tell you there is nobody here, including me, who would agree to any compromise. We have suffered so much during this time that hardly anything can make peace between us.
With peace talks unlikely anytime soon, frontline positions are fluctuating across hundreds of kilometers of Ukraine. Both sides will want to gain as much territory as possible before the winter comes, making advances more difficult. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
New jobs data in the United States showed a collapse of 1.1 million job openings, the biggest one-month crash ever outside of the COVID lockdown. It's also the first increase in the unemployment rate since April 2020, and that has many so-called recession deniers being